Accession number 30062, reel 9.
He said, "You were pulling us on board, the crew were getting everyone, all the survivors on board, and you said to me, 'Anyone here who's a gunner? Anyone used to being gunner on the Twin Oerlikon?' And he said, I had to say, 'Yes, sir.' And he said, 'Well, come over and start being a loading number on our, because we've lost a man there and we're in action.' So anyway, he said he felt a bit bad about it at the time, but he realised afterwards it was a sensible idea and he didn't bear any grudges. But at the time it must have felt like nothing on earth. But there we were with a lot of survivors from the other ship, and one badly wounded chap from our crew, and we were about 100 miles from our base. We hadn't been damaged particularly at all, so the return fire had not been extraordinary, but a few shells had hit the deck, and this one had hit the chap. And so we were just beginning to think whether we could get all the way to Maddalena, and a wireless message came through on RT. Sparker down below in the cabin, he came up with it and he said, "Instructions, sir, from Bobby Allen, really the commander in Maddalena, you are to proceed to the port of Bastia, which is only 30 miles away, where you'll find another of our boats making an exploratory look at Bastia to see if it's in suitable condition and whether it's suitable for a base for us." And we went over there and we went into the old harbour, which was one we never used again because we were in the new harbour, much bigger, later on. But I remember there were all these wounded people, with several of the 636's crew were wounded, and we had Jack Balderson was very badly wounded from our crew, and I was told by the captain that I was the only one who'd done French, because they were from Vancouver and didn't have to have French. And I was sent to this hospital, and I found the most awful conditions there, but just a few nuns. We didn't know if there were any doctors. We couldn't really converse very much with them. But we left Jack Balderson in their tender care, but surrounded by filth and everything else. And next day we heard that he died, and we gave him a funeral. Our first, and that I'm sure we did it at sea, but the detail really goes, it was all a bit much at that time. And there we had this awful mixed feelings of the terrible business of what they now call a blue on blue, which is, but in wartime, quite honestly, all this fuss about it, just like, I mean, Second World War people think about all the stresses and strains of traumatic stress. What's that? People, honestly, who served in the Second War wouldn't understand it at all, and our situation were often very much further from anybody, and with no... There was no thought in our minds ever of getting leave to go back home or anything like that. We were there for the duration, sort of thing. So that's a bit... So we were in a mixed state of emotions, but we were very proud of Corney, who led us into this situation, and it was a, in any other situations he would have been highly decorated, because it was to sink two enemy ships. It was just a pity it was also a terrible situation, so there was no pressing for awards or anything like that. And I know that since, it preyed on his mind the whole time, whether he could have done something different, you know. There we are. And the captain, we did rescue the captain of the of 636, and he knew Corney from Lowestoft in any case, and he agreed that it's exactly what happened, that one of his gunners had itchy fingers and on the trigger, and without waiting to be told to open fire, he had, and that caused it all. But there, now we did then return to Maddalena, because we weren't in a fit state, and there was no base at Bastia, and we got sorted out and did all we could for the wounded. And shortly after that,
Just before we move on, you were telling me before about how boats would be repaired in the temporary bases, about they'd be lifted up and...
Oh, yes. Any boat with any problems with its hull, if they needed to look underneath, obviously, would be put on a slip. And there were so many different types of slip. The easiest one, of course, is a dock that you float and... you know, and then get crutches underneath it, and then take out the water from underneath it, and then you can see everything. A dry dock, it's and that's easy if in a well-equipped place. But there are ways of doing it, of getting it up on a framework when you're sitting on top of a framework, and I've got pictures. Yes. Of 658 up on
in there somewhere.
In Mercedes Creek, which is where, just in Mars and Machette, there was a floating dock aboard a ship, you know, so that you could do the whole process and be up. And there's 658 sitting up with the crew painting underneath the whole thing, standing on a plank suspended over the side.
Wow.
And I got a picture with my Brownie, 1914 Brownie camera, which took all those pictures in there, in the 658 I've been showing Kathy. But there we are. Now, that was the end of that particular sequence, because then we were told during November, we were being repaired a bit during November, I think, and at Christmas we went back to Malta, but there were big plans being made, because Captain Coastal Forces had to decide how to dispose of all these forces which had been concentrated in Sicily, and how to dispense them, distribute them all over the Mediterranean where they were most needed. So one group went up to help with Salerno. No, that's a bit later. Yes, no, that's right. It was after Sicily when all this was happening, same time. One group went into to help at Salerno, and then operated in the Gulf of Naples, and they captured, politically anyway, Capri, and it was taken over by the US Navy as a rest camp, and also the island of Ischia, which was quite similar, and that was taken over by the, our Navy as a rest camp. And another group went right down to the Aegean, because if you think about it, it's nearly 1,000 miles from Gibraltar to Alexandria, and so it was a pretty long trip they did to get down there. But they went down there to work in the Aegean. Another group went to the Adriatic, and stayed roughly in the south of the Adriatic to start with. And so everyone was moving around at that time. And it was decided that also, after the experiences up to that date, it seemed that there were very few targets that were purely torpedo targets, that nearly all targets were going to be gun targets for the dog boats. All of them had quite strong armament. The MTBs among the dog boats, about half of them, were also got their torpedoes and rather less gunnery. But they decided that they'd mix up these types of boats into, there were still, we'd lost about 6 boats by then of the flotillas. So they formed three flotillas, of which they were roughly 4 gunboats and 4 torpedo boats. And that was a new invention, a new system, before it was done in UK or anything else. But it proved very useful, because if a big target did appear, then the torpedoes could be used. But largely we were firing at smaller targets, mostly slightly larger than us, but nevertheless small in themselves.
We did talk as well, just briefly, about the capability of the German capability compared to the MGBs, the capabilities of the E-boats.
The E-boats were the best of all Coastal Force boats, without any doubt. We were all absolutely, we agreed that. We respected the E-boats. What we didn't know is what their personnel were like. And obviously, if you had a good captain and a good crew, they had all the advantages of a non-vulnerable boat, because it was fueled by diesel, and that isn't inflammatory, like 100-octane petrol is. And they were much faster than any of our boats, and they had tactical advantage in that way. But incidentally, most of this was unimportant in the Mediterranean, because in fact there were very few E-boats. There was only one flotilla, the 7th E-boat flotilla. They called them S-boats, which was fast boats. And we called them E-boats because they were enemy boats. And so E-boats always, from our point of view, S-boats from theirs. And all their boats had numbers like ours, and they were called S so-and-so, all of them. And I've done a lot of research on where the where the various flotillas were, but they didn't get out to the Med more than 2 flotillas, I think, and at one stage there were hardly any left in the Med, but they reinforced with more later on. Now, so we were all dispersed around, and we formed this new flotilla, the 56th flotilla, which had all Canadian commanding officers, known by everybody else as the Cowboy Flotilla. But we set out and we went and formed our base at Bastia in Corsica, where Nelson lost his eye or something about there at the time. And he was also had the title of Senior Officer Inshore Squadron. That was Nelson's title when he was in Bastia. And interesting enough, they formed a Captain Royal Navy to be Senior Officer Inshore Squadron. And he was one we knew very well, and a good chap. And he worked extremely closely with Bobby Allen, who now came up to be the commander of the Bastia advanced base. And we all moved up to Bastia just about over New Year. And within a few days, in fact, it was the first time we operated as a flotilla. I can't remember the exact date, but we had 3 nights in a row when we had actions, which was quite incredible. But the reason for our finding and having 3 actions in a row was that they'd got very friendly with the American PT boats, which had the most wonderful radar, whereas our radar at the time, which was only worked by an aerial that you cranked a handle down in the WT, the wireless cabin, where the radar operator sat as well. And he would move the aerial on top of the mast by winding a handle. And if it got in the right angle for a target, if it was within 3 or 4 miles, we might see it. But the radar on the PT boats did the continuous rate going round with the screen showing, and it had a range of 30 miles. So we had to stop looking through binoculars if we were out with an American PT boat, and we used them as our eyes. And that became the big thing in the Mediterranean MTB war from then on. And the way it worked was that we asked one of them to go ahead of the 3 or 4 that were in our unit. We were in line ahead, but ahead of us was the PT boat. And once we'd got used to each other's names for things like port and starboard or left and right, we had some very amusing things happened, and but once we got used to it, the idea was that they found the targets by radar, perhaps at 15 miles, and knew exactly which way they were going, and they could calculate their speed, and we could get into position. And this is where the business of how an operation works out. You are looking for the enemy. You get into a position, very helpful if you already know it's there somewhere, and you get outside it so that you're looking in towards the shore and all in towards the moon, if that's possible. And then you can see every move it makes, and that's the stalking bit. So you stalked, and then you moved in quietly, and you got as close as you possibly could before they could see you. Not fast at all, you didn't use speed. Everything went as quiet as possible. And then when the senior officer reckoned he was in the most advantageous position, and he would allocate, if there were several enemy craft, and you had several boats, he would allocate which targets for each. And then we would quietly get in there, and so long as the boats were very close together, which they were we were very used to doing it, much closer than you would think of doing it like on a motorway, because it's quite similar really to be going at 20 knots on a motorway, and your boats are at sea and your boats are only 20 yards apart, you know, can be fraught with all sorts of problems.
It's a very good metaphor, actually. Yeah, it makes it much easier to visualise. Yeah.
So, but if we were close together, it meant that the five guns that could bear on the enemy from one boat was then multiplied into 20 if you had four boats, and that was a really killing sort of broadside. And it was that one thing, and the well-trained gunnery of the boats, that led to so much success from our knowledge, because that was the way it went all the time with us. Nobody ever had a question of being sunk in a firefight, because we sort of came out on top. D boats were different from the short boats, because the short boats could more easily be sunk, because they didn't have a large number of boats. They were of guns. They weren't really big like the D boats. Anyway, the first night we were sent off with this PT ahead, and it was to act as a diversion for the invasion of Anzio, which was down more or less on the mouth of the Tiber, in that area, and a town port of Civitavecchia, and we were to come from the north quietly, and to create a diversion about 5 or 6 miles north of Anzio. And incidentally, this was the first bit of psychological warfare. Oh no, it had been used at Alamein, apparently, just before the Battle of Alamein. And it was more or less the same thing. There was a ship all rigged for to make the possibility of sounds being picked up by the enemy, of anchors being weighed, of being anchors being dropped, and all sorts of things happening, and a bit of firing going on, lots of noise, to make it seem that there was a landing going on north, and they all hoped that the strategists hoped that some troops would be withdrawn from the area of the actual landing. Don't know if that worked at all, but from our point of view, that was all going on roughly where we were. But as we approached this point, we were told by the PT that we were approaching this area, and there was an enemy convoy coming inside us. So we told him to push off. It was our usual routine, because he couldn't do very much to help us. And then we got straight away involved with fighting about five of the enemy ships. It was really an excellent target and a way of doing it. And we sank four or five ships the first night. And full of joy, we all returned to Bastia, about 60 miles, I suppose, from there, and or 70, I don't remember. And then the next night, in order to keep up the pressure, two of those boats and two other boats that hadn't been used the night before formed another unit. We stayed aboard and went in and had our night in. And the third night, and they had an action. And then the third night, it was our turn, and we had an action, and it was quite good. a good one. I say good, what's good? A successful one, including these things called F-lighters, a flak lighter, which was quite like a big old barge, similar to a tank landing craft, low and roomy inside. But the F-lighters were designed to be heavily armoured, or rather they had big guns, much bigger than ours, inside a protection of concrete around them. This is aboard a boat, you don't expect that. But we all reckoned that although they could actually sink us if they hit at all with those things, that because they had this protection, they were always ducking down behind it and weren't very much use for firing it, whereas we had no real protection around our turrets at all. You know, just there was a shield, a gun shield, but if anything big enough hit it, it would be no use at all. But in that way, you don't have any possibility of sheltering behind anything.
You just know you need to fire.
Yeah. So that was that. And that was three nights in a row. And
you were telling me that you were beginning to develop a reputation by this point.
Yes, indeed. The 56 flotilla was the flavour of the month. And everyone, having 658 particularly, having sunk 636 was far... Well, nothing to laugh about it. It was awful. But here is an old man recounting how we felt as young men. There was a war to fight. It was our job to do it. You couldn't bring into it whether you were killing people or anything else. That wasn't the point, really. And I've said many, many times to people that there was no hatred involved at all. In fact, there was great good humour between... if anyone was sunk, we rescued a German. There was nothing but compassion for them, and they were looked after. And if they were officers, they were given scotch in the wardroom, and the lads were looked after in their new gear. They were given uniforms and, you know, sweaters and things to put on. Quite incredible. So that was, I think it was the 20th, the 21st and the 22nd of January, three in a row, in our new flotilla, the Canadian flotilla. So the morale was very, very high. And quite honestly, it continued like that, and I'm not going to go into a lot of these actions because they all were quite similar. Most of them involved a PT boat to do the...
reconnaissance.
Yes, the reconnaissance, the finding of the enemy, which made a huge difference to us. And I'd like to tell you about Bobby Allen's ventures, because he realised that there was an enormously great possibilities here in tackling. This was after this time, even though we were always on operations, we couldn't always, if the moon was up, for instance, if it was a period of bright moon, we could never get close enough to the F-lighters, which were our main target, because they could see us and fire at us with their larger guns at much further range than we could get using ours. And we had many occasions when we were thoroughly, I was going to say pissed off, but...
You can say that.
May I?
You may.
Yeah. Because we were feeling very depressed that we couldn't get up. Well, Bobby Allen reasoned that using the PT boats, with every cooperation from their senior officer, who was a great chap, that